We can go on from there to Acts chapter 1. This is the passage in which Jesus ascends into heaven. Verse 9, after Jesus had said all these things as they were looking on, he was lifted up and the cloud took him out of their sight. While they were gazing up, two men in white robes said, "Men of Galilee, why do you stand looking into heaven? This Jesus who was taken up from you into heaven will come in the same way as you saw him go." Now this is a point at which the cloud itself does not contain the glory of God. In other words, it's not as though God is coming in the cloud. This is the cloud now becomes, I suppose you might say, the vehicle by which Jesus ascends into heaven. But again, the cloud bears the glory of the Lord, and that part would be true in the ascension. So that just that use of the cloud that is there, just another example of that same idea of God's glory. And then drawing upon something that's not in Scripture, I gave you a passage from the Exultet. The Exultet is that is the hymn that we sing, or the hymn that the priest sings at the Easter Vigil, and it's much longer, but This is a part of it that relates especially to the pillar of fire. This is after the Easter fire has been blessed, and then we come in and we bless the Easter candle, and the candle is blessed, the incense grains are put into the candle and so forth, and then everyone else is holding their candles, and then we say some of these things that are part of the Exultet. He says, "This is the night when the pillar of fire destroyed the darkness of sin." There's a lot of imagery in here that goes back to the Passover to say, this is the night. Remember what Moses said, when generations to come and they ask, why do we do this? Tell them, this was the night at which we were set free from the Egyptians by the blood of the Lamb. Well, in the Exultet, we use some of those lines. This is the night. This is the night when the pillar of fire destroyed the darkness of sin. Remember what I said before is that In the Exodus story, you really can't entirely separate the Passover from the crossing of the Red Sea. The Passover, the death of the firstborn, and the crossing of the Red Sea. They all sort of become part of one moment. It happens on more than one day, but one moment at which all of this act of salvation, of saving the people from slavery to the Egyptians, takes place. In the same way that Holy Thursday and Good Friday and Easter Sunday all form one moment in salvation history at which we're freed from sin. So here we recall not just simply the blood of the Lamb, like Passover night that set us free, but we also recall the pillar of fire, which is a reminder of the flight to the Red Sea and the crossing of the Red Sea. So we're pulling in all these images from Exodus 12, 13, 14, and 15, this whole sort of Passover Exodus event, and reminding ourselves then of the glorious redemption we have from the Last Supper, Jesus' crucifixion and his resurrection. So it's all sort of folded in to one mystery, and so that's why we hear a lot of these images, and they're being brought together, woven together into this Exultet. And so here we have the pillar of fire for us, the Easter candle, the pillar of the Easter candle. Except this Easter candle, a flame divided but undimmed. Divided, why? Because the one Easter candle is brought in, and from it the other candles are lit that everyone's carrying at the Easter vigil. So the flame is divided, but each flame continues to burn and it grows ever brighter. A pillar of fire that glows to the honor of God. Let it mingle with the lights of heaven and continue bravely burning to dispel the darkness of this night. Remember there was a passage I gave you before about the idea of the flame continuing to burn. The sanctuary candle burning as long as the presence of God is there. We had an Old Testament passage about the sacrifice continuing to burn as a continual offering back to the Lord. And so this is the pillar of fire that is not extinguished. It does not go out. It continues bravely burning. May the morning star, which never sets, find this flame still burning. Christ, that morning star, who came back from the dead and shed his peaceful light on all mankind, your Son, who lives and reigns forever and ever. So Christ is the light. We have that passage from the New Testament. Christ is that morning star, the source of our salvation. And so we have the Easter candle representing in the Old Testament time the pillar of fire, the Easter candle also shining forth to us the light of Christ. Just wonderful ways in which we bring all those different images together into our celebration of the Eucharist, and especially at the Easter Vigil. So just our liturgy, it's saturated in Scripture, just immersed in Scripture. There's so much of that that's there. So now I jump back to Exodus 14, and at this point then we continue our journey through Exodus as we go from the Passover, the departure from Egypt, and now the crossing of the Red Sea. This is verses 10 through 31, so it's a little bit of a longer passage, but we'll kind of read some excerpts from this. I think a lot we're very familiar with this really pivotal passage. When Pharaoh drew near, the people of Israel lifted up their eyes. Behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they were in great fear. The people of Israel cried out to the Lord, and they said to Moses, "Is it because there were no graves in Egypt that you've taken us away to die in this wilderness?" You hear just the tremendous fear on the part of the Hebrews at this moment. Verse 13, then Moses says to the people, "Fear not and stand firm. You will see the salvation of the Lord, which he will work for you today. The Egyptians whom you see today, you will never see again. It is the Lord who will be fighting for you." Verse 15, then, the Lord then says to Moses, then tell the people to go forward. Verse 16, lift up your rod, stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, that they may go through the ground, on dry ground through the sea. And this, he does this, verse 19, the angel of God who went before the host of Israel moved and went behind them, and the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them. It came between the hosts of Egypt and Israel, and so preventing them from coming any closer together. Moses stretched his hand out over the sea in verse 21. It was divided. Verse 22, the people of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, the waters being a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. The Egyptians pursued and went after them into the midst of the sea. Verse 24, in the morning the Lord, in the pillar of fire and of cloud, looked down upon the host of the Egyptians and discomfited the host of the Egyptians, clogging their chariot wheels so that they drove heavily. The Egyptians said, "Let us flee before Israel because the Lord fights against the Egyptians." Verse 26, Moses stretches out his hand over the sea. And verse 28, the waters returned and covered the chariots, the hosts of Pharaoh and that followed them into the sea, not so much as one of them remained. Verse 29, but the people of Israel walked on dry ground through the sea, the waters being like a wall to their right and to their left. This is just a tremendous passage as you see the power of the Lord, not only protecting them from the Egyptians, but also doing something which is really considered impossible. The Lord takes a situation that seems like it would be an utter catastrophe, something that is without hope, something at which complete destruction seems to be assured, and out of this brings the greatest of all possible outcomes, an outcome that they could not have foreseen. That's part of the mystery of salvation history, about the way we see these things unfold. If I were to take you from Holy Thursday and Good Friday to Easter Sunday, could I not say the same thing about that? A situation at which it looks like all is lost, complete catastrophe, the worst of all possible outcomes, utter destruction is assured. But then from that, there's a complete reversal, and then we see the best of all possible outcomes. The exultet, we say on Easter, we talk about the happy fault of Adam, the necessary sin of Adam that won for us so great a Redeemer. That just when it seems as though everything is lost, the people on the road to Emmaus say, "We thought this was the Christ. We thought this was the Messiah. We hoped for more." They got more than they could ever have expected, but it seems as though their hopes were dashed, but instead they experienced salvation. There are so many things about that become so important. We've already, I think, mentioned the idea of the symbolism of baptism, not only in the flood from Noah, but we also can talk about baptism in the crossing of the Red Sea, that idea that they go into the waters. They walk into the waters as slaves to the Egyptians, but when they emerge from the waters on the other side, they come out as free people, no longer enslaved by the Egyptians, but with their slavery having been buried in the waters of the Red Sea. Well, we also talk about baptism, coming into the water of baptism, a slave of sin, because affected by original sin, emerging from the waters of baptism as a free-born child of God. Adopted as the child of God. We say they are a child of God, for so indeed they are, set free from sin by the grace of baptism. So there's another great image that we have in terms of our liturgy that we can draw upon. And maybe one other thing about the idea of crossing into the Red Sea and baptism. Sometimes you'll see in different churches a separate baptistry. There, and sometimes, especially if you travel through Europe, sometimes this would even be a totally separate building. Have you ever seen a place, especially some of the cathedrals, where there'd be a baptistry that would be at a completely separate building? Is that something that you've seen? When they do that, it's really an elaborate thing that you can see, where there is a large pool, oftentimes, where baptism would take place. One of the things that would happen as people were baptized, especially if there is a large pool, and it was built in such a way that this could be done, is they would walk into the pool on one side and to be baptized, and they would emerge from the pool on the other side. I mean, there was really a sense that you were crossing, just as the passage through the Red Sea. You went on one side and you came out on the other, and that was when the change took place. In fact, even sometimes in some baptistries, you would even see steps going down, and how many steps would there be? There'd be three. Okay, there'd be three steps going down and three steps coming up to represent the 3 days. On the third day, Jesus would rise, and so you have that sense of three, sometimes even in their baptism, reminding them very much of this passage through the Red Sea. And I'd like to go also right on to Exodus 15, because this is another really important thing about what the people do once they're saved. This is a key thing. They've just gone through one of the very dramatic moments in the history of salvation, from the sacrifice of the Passover lamb, the blood on the door, being the death of the firstborn of the Egyptians, being practically begged to leave Egypt, and yet they pursue them later on, and they're going to bring them back. What were we thinking? We're going to go after them and bring them back at the Red Sea, the parting of the waters, and they emerge. And so what do? Exodus 15, they sing. They sing a hymn. Okay. Now, you think that singing is not important. Singing is important. It's an important part of liturgy is the singing of hymns. For Exodus 15, verse 1, then Moses and the people of Israel sang this song to the Lord, saying, I will sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. Horse and his rider he has thrown into the sea. The Lord is my strength and my song. He has become my salvation, and so forth. So you can really hear the whole song that is there, even as they recount elements of what has happened to them, like verse 9. The enemy said, I will pursue, I will overtake, I will divide the spoil. My desire shall have its fill of them. I will draw my sword, and my hand will destroy them. Verse 10, you did blow your wind, the sea covered them. They sank as lead in the mighty waters. Who is like the Lord our God? I mean, it's a retelling of parts of the story, but it's being done in song and in hymn. Now, this is one of the first times at which you have such a clear hymn of praise being sung to the Lord after a moment of salvation. But it's certainly not the only time. You think of any other times? I guess I have a couple in here. But one of the probably the best examples of a hymn-like structure in the Bible is also in the Old Testament. Yeah, but go ahead. You were going to say? At the Last Supper? At the Last Supper, they sang hymns before going out to the Mount of Olives. I was thinking of the Last Supper and that. There's a mention in the Scriptures about them singing hymns. But then, as a book of the Bible, the book of Psalms is a whole collection of different hymns of praise. The Psalms, it's sometimes difficult for us to get a sense of the lyrical nature of it or the way in which you chant those things, because we're talking about an English translation of something originally written in a different language, in Hebrew. Sometimes it can be hard to translate from one language to another and still capture the whole, the poetic aspect of it. Because when you think of poetry or song or hymns, oftentimes there may be a meter or a rhythm to it, but there's also a kind of a cadence or even the pronunciation of something, or whether or not something rhymes specifically. But sometimes you get a pattern with the words, you get a sense or a feel for that there's almost a rhythmic nature of singing a hymn.